Now, some good news this weekend for railway fans. The Otago Daily Times has reported that the Dunedin City Council wants to keep the Tidy Gorge rail route open and Kiwi Rail's coastal line north from Dunedin. But the bad news, the rest of our passenger rail network currently covers a shorter distance than it did back in the 1870s. Now, quite how we lost so much of it over the last 100 years is the focus of a fantastic new illustrated book called Can't Get There From Here, New Zealand Passenger Rail from 1920, and it was put together with great care and rigour by Andre Brett, who's a Kapiti coaster, who's now a history lecturer in Australia, and a pretty good one, apparently. He's just won Australia's prestigious Max Crawford Medal for outstanding academic achievement. And the book, by the way, is published here by Otago University Press. It's not in the shops just yet, but pre-orders are available. But in the book, Andre Brett also tackles the question of should we and could we build rail back better like we did in the past? I'd like to start, if I could, by taking you back to before the period of this one. So this is passenger rail from 1920 to the present day. But the last time we spoke, it was about your previous book, Acknowledge No Frontier. And this was about the creation and demise of the New Zealand provinces before the nation was fully knitted up. And rail played quite a big part in that. Was there not a story about I think Southland almost going broke as a result of trying to run a railway up to the central Otago goldfields on wooden rails?
Yes, Southland is the comedic example of this. You have some quite perhaps depressing stories elsewhere where, you know, you have in Auckland province, the original reason to construct a railway south from Auckland to the Waikato was to support the war effort. So, you know, that is one of those, you know, quite confronting aspects of our history that I'm not sure New Zealand is yet fully grappling with, but is, I think, doing much better now than even 5 years ago when I wrote that book. Whereas Southland provides a comedic relief. Sorry to the Southlanders out there. They decided to try to build this railway quickly and cheaply, and so they chose to use wooden rails, but rather unfortunately skimped on the project by using unsuitable softwood. The locomotive tore up the tracks and the railway was not terribly useful and, yeah, basically sent the province bankrupt.
Bugger. But it's interesting that there was, I guess, a real enthusiasm for building rail that we seem to lack in more recent years. And in the book, you say that today we are down to, I think, less than about 1,500 kilometres of track for passenger services. And that, if you go back, as you do in the book, so that's about the lowest total since the 1870s.
That's correct. So the final years of the provincial period, basically first half of the 1870s, you have Julius Vogel's Great Public Works policy, and railways just spread rapidly throughout New Zealand. It's one of, you know, the great periods of infrastructure expansion in the country, where about 2,000 kilometres of rail are built in the space of a decade. And on all of that, you could expect passenger trains as well as goods trains. Whereas today, New Zealand does have a network of about 4,000 kilometres of track, but less than half of that is used for passenger trains. And even much of the total network that is used for passenger is primarily three tourist trains that run infrequently and are quite expensive, so they're not very useful for just, you know, the general everyday traveller. It's now just Wellington and Auckland that have, you know, meaningful everyday or rail transport, whereas up until 1960s or so, this was an everyday expectation throughout the country.
Well, looking at the maps in your book by your collaborator Sam van Veerden, lovely illustrated and stylized maps of the passenger network as it was, it triggered in my mind a trip I made, I think this must have been early 1990s, doing a bit of tramping, staying in someone's place in National Park, and coming upon a yellowing National Railway map book and timetable, and looking at it, this is from some years back, but just thumbing through it and looking at it, think all these passenger lines that were there timetabled not that long before, and thinking, you know, no way. And I guess in the foreword to the book, you've got Anthony Tonnen, the musician. He talks about, I think, growing up or living in Dunedin and finding remnants of railways that didn't exist, that he didn't even know about in the areas where he grew up. I mean, what was it for you that made you want to focus in this level of detail about the rail that we've lost and the rail we might be able to get back for the future?
Well, Anthony's to blame for a lot of this, actually, and I say that in the absolute nicest way. There was a discussion between him and I and a few other people on Twitter about, you know, when was the network at its greatest extent? And this is, you know, one of those like late night online discussions, and I'm just, you know, thinking to myself, as somebody who has been interested in the history of rail in New Zealand since as a little boy, I was like, oh yeah, I can probably put together a bit of a timeline to see when the network was at its peak. And so I knocked up something quite hasty. And then the next morning I looked at it and I thought, there's something more to write here, isn't there? How did we lose such a large network so rapidly? Initially, there's some quite significant expansion in the 1920s to the 1940s. And I think, you know, the maps really capture how the regional trunk network took shape during that period. And then you have the much more, you know, negative story of how rail then retreats from the New Zealand landscape. And yeah, I think the maps bring that to life.
Yeah, I mean, they completely do. For example, in the first chapter from 1920, Sam's maps are right there. So you could look at it, for instance, you can see there's a little branch route from Otira to Greymouth. There's one from Whangarei to Kaikoi with stops on the way. Even a kind of, I guess, a branch line, if that's the right word, from Tynwald, just south of, I think, Ashburton, up to Mount Somers and Springburn, in the Canterbury region. I mean, it's just incredible to think there would have been regular passenger services operating, you know, ticketed, available in places like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, that these were services that generally ran daily. Some of the very rural lines ran generally, say, about three times a week. But usually you could anticipate a daily service, that it would connect on main lines with expresses between different towns and major cities. These weren't necessarily very fast trains. New Zealand trains were often quite slow by international standards. But they got you places. They served all of the communities along the route. They were an absolutely everyday aspect of how we got around our country, moving both people and goods. And goods is a separate story and probably a bigger one. But passenger transport is railway's shop window, if you will. This is, you know, how it is usually engaged with by citizens. It's how it, you know, gets its, you know, social license, how it builds support for government funding, at least during the periods when it has been state-owned. I think it was often an underrated aspect of New Zealand Railways operations, that they saw goods as where, you know, the profits could potentially be made, but passenger rail was just absolutely crucial to how the general population understood rail transport.
In the foreword, Anthony Tonnen mentioned that a lot of lines closed from the 2000s on, when we had Transrail, the sale of New Zealand Rail to Transrail, and so on, the whole, I guess, Wisconsin intervention, if I can call it that. And he says this is a shame that because, you know, the internet was just getting going at that point, and he said there are a lot of things you can't easily look up. But I would have thought, maybe I'm stereotyping here, but I would have thought rail would have had some of the most dedicated nerds filing away, you know, offline type material and cataloguing it, and that it actually wouldn't be that hard to track down a lot of the details about the services that were operating in the past.
Oh, for sure. And it sort of depends which services you're talking about there. In terms of, you know, the flagship express trains or the, you know, regional expresses or the rail cars that served so many country areas, these are generally quite well attested. But a lot of the regional service, a lot of the rural services, especially in the steam era, it can sometimes be hard to track down information, or there's, you know, conflicting information. I was sometimes surprised when, you know, I dig into the official records and find, you know, communication that revealed that actually the cancellation date that had been, you know, reported in the rail enthusiast literature, you know, in full good faith, had turned out that it was actually off by sometimes even just by, you know, a couple of months or a couple of weeks. But I think all good historical research goes back and follows up everybody's footnotes and sees who they lead. And I fully expect some people are going to find I've made a couple of blunders as well. So that's a part and parcel of doing history.
Passenger rail from 1920, that's the starting point. What was it that we had then? And in that period, say, from there to, I think, almost the signpost you put in 1945, end of the war, and the peacetime economy. So between that period, was it a case of expansion in that 25-year span?
Yeah, so, you know, I wanted to try to cover a full century. I thought that was a good sort of time period to look at. And 1920 is quite a convenient start point because World War I is over. You know, people are starting to look to the future. And at that point, rail has many different passenger roles. And during the 1920s is when expansion into lightly populated rural areas basically ends. They're still pushing on major regional lines. For instance, in 1920, Gisborne is not linked to the rest of the country. The West Coast is not linked to the rest of the country. The Otira Tunnel under Southern Alps is close to completion and is about to end, you know, 50 years of the West Coast, the Greymouth Railway being isolated, but, you know, it's not quite there. And so although the, you know, role in the most lightly populated rural areas starts to recede in the 1920s, you still have this absolutely essential service linking regions, and that endures well into the 1950s and 60s.
Towards the end of the book, you say poor administration and policy making have left New Zealand with an attenuated railway and passenger network unfit for the 21st century. And we'll come to the future later, but further down, you said, look, one of the factors that contributed to this was actually in that period, the 20s through to 1940, New Zealand Railways started its own road services. So was the fact that the same outfit providing the rail passengers with their transport was also deciding to put buses on the road, that must have helped kill off some of those smaller networks that you talked about.
Yes, and one of my key points throughout the book is that we should not take it as inevitable that New Zealand has ended up as a car-dependent society with very limited options beyond private automobiles on roads. Although, you know, it might seem as if it was inevitable, this was actually the result of an accumulation of decisions, many of which were seemingly small decisions. And the New Zealand Railways Road Services is an interesting one because the idea itself is not actually bad. That, you know, the railway obviously could not go everywhere, and providing a road service to link railway terminals with areas beyond the network was quite a good idea. For instance, you know, you might want seasonal routes to summer resorts where it would not make any financial sense to build a railway and try to run something year round, but you're going to want connections at Christmas. Or you might have, you know, your very isolated rural communities, say around East Cape, that you're going to want a bus service to connect that to expresses from Gisborne to the Hawke's Bay in Wellington. But what happened was that many railway officials started to see buses as sort of this way of the future, buying into ideas of modernity, often influenced by ideas that were current in America. Or they introduced services that ended up just competing with existing railway operations, sometimes made not, you know, out of serious planning that this was going to be, you know, a good way to balance services, but simply for the convenience of whoever was timetabling it, that, you know, taking easy options rather than better options.
And you've described it also as a kind of slow winding down of services after 1945. There was you've called it in the chapter heading the drift to road. I guess the peacetime economy was the kind of driver, no pun intended, to cars and roads, but a slow winding down of rail services that was perhaps not that well noticed or acknowledged as it was happening because it was so piecemeal, but also that it wasn't always a case of closure, of, you know, committees meeting and, look, we've weighed it up, it's not being used, we'll shut it down, but of kind of deferred investment and just why growth has stopped was actually the key, not actually shutting anything down.
Exactly. And so you've got instances of where services just gradually decline over a period of years, where the carriages are no longer in a good condition. People don't particularly want to ride them. They might not have heating in winter, for instance. And so, you know, the patronage appears to be going down. So the New Zealand Railways decides to run the train less frequently, which dissuades even more people. So the train is run even less frequently. Even more people leave. You can see how this is a vicious cycle and leads to a service in a rural area in particular being cancelled with very few people noticing, or those who care the most are farmers who have still got goods trains serving them. And so that's what they're most worried about rather than a passenger service. And one of my big points in the book is that these changes that initially go little noticed in rural areas, you know, are harbingers of much larger changes elsewhere on the network, that gradually it winds down the health of the whole network.
And one of the tragedies is we not only lost the services, but also some fairly cool names. The Blue Streak rail car, you've got a photo of it here on south of Te Kuiti on the Northern Main Trunk Line. You know, I would have ridden anything called the Blue Streak.
It's a great looking rail car as well.
Well, I'm talking to Andre Brett. He's the author of Can't Get There From Here, New Zealand Passenger Rail from 1920, and that's published by Otago University Press, and also with those fine maps we've been talking about by mapmaker Sam van der Veerden. Now, Andre, in the book, the last part of it is about the future, so it's not all this kind of sad story about a form of transport we had and have largely lost. So you say the networks must grow again so we can get there from here. And pictures like, for example, pointing out that Hastings, you know, has freight trains rolling pretty much right down the centre of the town, that these things, in some cases, the infrastructure is there, the services could actually run if we wanted them.
Exactly. And I didn't want to just tell a depressing story. I'm the sort of person who does always look for solutions. And I'm also the sort of person who's very ambitious for New Zealand. I hope that is what comes across in my conclusion, that I would love to come home and come home to a better country, one that I think can really be truly great. And part of that is providing people with modal choice, that there are all sorts of economic and social benefits to providing different forms of mobility so that people have a choice of how they get there from here, especially with our changing climate, that we really do need to emphasise transport like rail that is very energy efficient, that can do what cars can't, that the energy efficiency of steel wheels on steel rails is literally unbeatable. And I think this has to be part of New Zealand's future, both in terms of local commuter traffic, in terms of intercity travel, and in terms of linking cities and towns with their surrounding regions. Where the infrastructure still exists and can be upgraded to carry passengers, it should be upgraded. It should carry passengers. New Zealand can have it all. It can be so much better.
It would cost a fortune, though, wouldn't it? And, you know, cars are everywhere. There's a lot of pressure to build roads. I mean, you say you're ambitious, but these really are major projects that would have to be phased in over a lot of years, right?
Major projects, yes, but New Zealand is often too willing to accept ludicrously long time periods and spends a lot of time talking about things and not much actually doing them. From the 1950s onward, conscious decisions turned New Zealand from a country with good modal choice into one that was car dependent. It wasn't inevitable. We built this and we can build our way out of it. Getting around by rail, by other forms of public transport, by active transport, that these can be better than car dependency. That, you know, it's much nicer to travel by train than being stuck in a traffic jam. That if we've got a good balance of transport options, people can choose what suits their needs rather than just being, you know, forced into a car, and we can do it much quicker than we think we can. hopefully in the next couple of decades, there will be enough momentum that we've gone from a rail network that was in managed decline up until the 2010s, that has now had, you know, some investment in it to at least put it in decent working order, and it is now time to grow. And if we're thinking about a post-COVID future, I think that rail and other forms of public and active transport have to be a key part of that future.
Well, Andre, there's plenty for nostalgics to look at in your book and enjoy, and to kind of reflect on the networks we had that we have lost. But as you've just been saying, a plan for the future, a blueprint even, is all part of the book. Can't Get There From Here. And look, the title, it's a song, isn't it? And presumably from a band you admire?
Yes, it's a bit of a nod to one of my favourite songs by R.E.M., and when I was trying to think, what am I going to call this book, I thought, it's got to be something about how disconnected the network is, and just had that bolt of inspiration. Like, yeah, got to give a nod to that song. It just encapsulates the reality of New Zealand rail passenger transport for the past few decades.